On behalf of the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders, I would like to welcome you all today for this very inspiring and informative program. It is such a privilege for us to feature Martinez. She is a child with chronic intestinal pseudoobstruction and a very long journey in getting that diagnosed and still going through the process of this amazing journey that they've had with chronic illness. Julie is, as you just heard, from California, and she's going to talk a little bit more about herself. She's an extraordinary lady. She has written a book about her journey, and it's hopefully going to be published soon. And that in itself is a phenomenal feat. And she graciously offered to volunteer our organization in several capacities, so we are grateful for that as well. On that note, Julie, can you talk a little bit about yourself and a little bit about your daughter?
Sure. So I am, as Mary Angela said, married, live in Southern California, married for a long time. We have one child. And she's 14, and I work part-time for a HUD agency, sort of like a personal advocate for public, help to the public for housing issues. And so it's a good fit for me as far as advocating for the underdog. So I've had a child since, I think since birth, that had problems. I was sent home from the hospital with a newborn that I'd only had like the meconium right when they're born, no poop after that, nothing on into the second week of life. And so I think her problems were from birth, but there was a lull in her problems and then resurfaced hard and fast immediately at about 2 years old, where everything just stopped. So she went from, you know, she's still in diapers at this point, you know, pooping every day, to it just halting. It just stopped completely and went to, you know, 5 to 7 days was now the new norm, which produced a child that didn't feel well half the time. So she would go to the bathroom and then feel good and have relief. And then the other half of the time, it was be comparable to having a child that had the flu. So I was not running back and forth to the emergency. I did not think my child was going to die. I really didn't even think it was would ever get as serious as it did. But I immediately started having trouble in the medical world with getting her help, because at her general pediatrician at that level, constipation is such a common complaint. It's like coming in there and saying, you know, my child, you know, doesn't like milk or something. It was very, very common. So I was given all the normal things, you know, over the counter, and even, you know, food things to avoid or push that didn't help and didn't work, and no one seemed to kind of get it. So I pretty quickly, in less than a year, moved on to a pediatric facility specialist, gastro doctor, and went to a large facility near me with very reputable specialists, and that's where we were told that I described her behavior, described the problem, and was told that it was behavioral. So as frustrating as that was, I was actually grateful. I was very grateful that it was a behavioral issue, and I thought, perfect, I can tackle that. I can handle that as long as something's not wrong with her physically. Something medically is not necessarily wrong. This is a stress issue. So while I battled with feeling horrible that my child had so much stress at, you know, by 24 or 36 months old, I couldn't figure out how she would have such anxiety. When I considered myself a attentive mother, that this was blamed on anything behavioral was troubling to me. But I embraced it because nothing medically was diagnosed, anything else wrong. And so that is where I stuck in the caregiving mode with my daughter for 8 years, that this was a behavioral problem. And unfortunately, we did not move on to any other specialist until she was about 10. And then I had some concrete definite other things that her problem started to morph into, where something else was horribly wrong. So that's where I approached and cared for my child for 8 years. So in talking to Mary Angela and in writing, you know, I'm not one to give advice necessarily about caregiving with anybody else, especially with a child, because it's so personal and so specific to your own circumstances. But I can give all kinds of advice about, you know, other things with caregiving. I have a sister-in-law that cares for parents, and I always am telling her what to do and what might be helpful and better, because it's such a stressful position to be in, caregiving at any level, and sometimes not a lot of payoff. But there's a tremendous amount of confusion and misconception about getting diagnosed, at least with a pseudo-obstruction, that unfortunately my angle on caregiving for my child was, I thought, could be corrected by, you know, lecturing and scolding and encouraging, and then there would be sometimes a good result, and I would think, well, yeah, I just have to scold her more, or I just have to, I never punished her or anything like that, but there was some heavy duty, you know, I would make her feel bad, you know, that she could control this more, that she should try harder to control this more. So that being balanced with what I wanted to be effective at in helping her help herself, with it making both of us feel horribly bad all the time. I always felt bad. She always felt bad. And then sometimes when she would have success, then I would think, oh, okay, what I'm doing is working. So I have a lot of struggle even now about, you know, balancing that with everything else you balance in your life when you're raising a child, your work and the family dynamics and keeping things peaceful and keeping your child up and happy. And it was just a constant daily struggle. I never could achieve any kind of balance in that direction. And so by nature, I'm very nurturing type of person. That's not to brag at all, but it is demonstrates how driven I always am for answers, driven, can't sleep at night type of driven person to fix and solve and seek justice and make things fair and make things right. So while nurturing is a good quality in most, it can be almost maddening if you're faced with a problem that you cannot fix. And talk about one with a kid. I don't know if there's any other parents on the phone, but if you have something with your kid that you cannot solve or fix yourself, and then you pay specialists to pay, you know, to pay them and hire them basically to fix and figure out and don't get answers there, that in and of itself is why I had to sit down and write, because it was put us in a position as a family and myself, especially my daughter, where it just about did us in. So reaching out to Mary Angela and others is
one
good.
Second. Mm-hmm. Second, but Ina and everybody else, trying to get to the end of the program to ask questions, so if you can contain yourself down, if you're going to forget comments or questions, would be great. I'm going to be asking some Julie some questions, but if you can wait, that would be great. But we only have a limited amount of time, and it's get off tangent. But Julie, your child, you don't have any other children.
No. Heck no. I couldn't. I couldn't do it. I could only do this one good.
So as a result of that, well, I guess you'd say like the arguments or the bone of contention between you and your daughter as a result of saying this is behavior, you need to do this, and the rebuttal, all of that, I'm sure the way you handled it and possibly still handle it affected you and has made you very guilty. Is that true?
Yeah, so as I said, the first I want to say that my gratitude for her health now, which is good, our story has a happy ending, my gratitude outweighs my guilt. So I don't sit around and marinate about it, but I certainly had moments when I just was at my wit's end with her, because she very, from a very young age, was absolutely resolved to accept her little lot in life, that this was how her little body was going to function, and that this was how her little body was going to work forever. So she had a high level of acceptance for this, and so her little mindset versus my little mindset were not on the same page. And so although I've always enjoyed a close relationship with my child, and she's a very dependent type of a little girl. She's very almost a little obsessed with me. She just has always been like a little mama's girl, but her mindset was different than my own. And so, you know, trying to get to her, trying to reach her, and trying to motivate her at the same time of trying to be understanding and nurturing and, you know, do what I could to support her in her just complete terror a lot of times was just, I mean, as mad as I wanted to be, sometimes my husband and I would go into the room and we would usually fluctuate in being mad or being upset or being guilty, and we would always conclude at one of those episodes, she can't help it. This kid can't help it. Even if she does hold it and there's a certain amount of behavioral component to this, she can't help herself. And so my approach was always people in general need to try harder. They have to work harder. They have to try harder. It's mind over matter. And for that to fail, for my approach to fail with my own child and then to have to feel guilty about that all the time was, you know, really exhausting. So finding a balance was just near impossible. I never quite got it down. So sometimes I would feel like I did a good job and helped her, and other times I just knew I was blowing it while I was doing it. And it was just absolutely, you know, left everybody feeling bad. So I certainly am not in a position to give advice on how to handle a child. But the guilt that dominated the illness and mothering a child with an illness is probably a common complaint that people feel guilty. And trying to, you know, raise a child to be independent and self-sufficient and be happy and all those things while there's so many things that pull them in the other direction that you feel are out of your control, or at least I did. I was just always torn about that. Having her try to develop the ability to help herself when really she wasn't strong enough. She wasn't strong enough or old enough. But I think that guilty feeling comes as soon as you're handed a baby. I mean, I don't know where that comes from or why, but I think as soon as you have a baby, you automatically are questioning yourself or feeling like you need to do more or that you're doing too much, you know, that you smother. And so it's definitely my tendency to smother on top of mother and on top of scold. So, you know, that's just the kind of child I had, and I tried to navigate through that as best as I could. But the pooping versus not pooping, being hopeful versus being completely hopeless, left everyone in our family feeling bad in every direction. So I've learned a lot about motherhood and the illness and myself and life in general. So I'm completely way humbled, and I, you know, I'm just not an expert on any of it, but it's been therapeutic to be able to talk to others about
Julie,
it.
Julie, when you found out that your child was in fact ill,
mm-hmm.
How did it make you feel when you saw other children or babies that were well?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm one to be jealous, but I was always very jealous. You know, I remember joking with people when they would talk about having a new baby or not sleeping or trouble nursing or trouble with colic or just the normal mother complaints, you know, with a baby. And I would always sort of jokingly ask, does your baby poop? And people would laugh, aha, it's so funny, of course they poop, you know, six times a day. And I would say, oh, you should, you know, cherish those dirty diapers. You know, that's a, such a blessing to have that. But, yeah, I would, I'd have to say I was quite quite jealous because by age two, my daughter's regimen for medication would be comparable to what people have when they have a colonoscopy. That would be on a weekly basis. Sometimes if she was really backed up and she would go up to 2 weeks, 16 days without going to the bathroom. So our regimen, sometimes day to day, back to back, were comparable to what people would do for colonoscopy. So very, very hard on your body, up to 12 or more doses of Miralax per day, bottles of max citrate, more than one in a day sometimes. Anything you can think of over the counter was at some point woven to her regimen to get her to go. And it sometimes those worked for years, those worked, and then everything stopped working as she got older. So, you know, people would complain about maybe their kid not taking cough syrup or spitting it out in their face or something like that, you know, where they're dealing with a child that's sick temporarily. So to which the whole medicine regimen created a whole nother aspect of guilt. A huge part of it was just the daily regimen that this kid had to, and stuff she'd have to ingest to try to go, try to keep her regular was just, I mean, a grown man wouldn't have even been able to go to work or leave the house. And yet I had this child that I had to, you know, get stuff in her before, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning going to school. It was just a joke. I can't even believe we did it for so long. So, yeah, when I saw other people's kids or babies or things that they would comment on about caring or raising their child, I just felt really alone in that process.
Talk to me about that. Well, it's, I guess you would say it's like a the balancing between feeling hopeless and hopeful, and pushing that doting versus feeling bad and that lack of balance. In order to give our audience a little bit more insight, can you just read an excerpt from your book regarding that?
Sure, sure. So I'll read, let's see.
What is the name of the book?
I don't know the name of the book yet. I really don't. I'm trying to think of something tactful that wouldn't be too, you know, too much of a turnoff with the subject. So I don't know yet. It's kind of something that's up in the air. I've got a few friends that have input and that kind of thing. So I don't know yet. The book I hoped would be done by the summer. It's done being written. It's just being edited now, and now I have to start fixing so much of the edits. So it's a work in progress. I hoped it would be up this summer on Amazon. I'm just going to self-publish, but I don't think I'll have it done until probably the fall. So I'm going to work very hard on it. So I'll talk about
more just a reminder, and to everybody, if you can kind of contain your questions, there'll be ample time at the end. That way there, and just be mindful of the time element within our program. Go ahead, Julie.
So the excerpts that I've chosen, I'm only going to read a couple parts of each excerpt, not the whole entire thing. So this is about when she's 2 years old. So the straining and pain progressed to Elise crying during her efforts to either hold poop or go poop. Most of the time, I couldn't tell which she was actually doing, holding it or successfully going. Sometimes it was a combination of the two. She'd beg me to sit with her in the bathroom, hold her hand. Then I go on and talk about some other stuff. None of the other mom friends with little ones or children slightly older than her had anything to suggest. I did have two friends that had gone through something similar with their own child being constipated, but nothing that persisted for weeks or months or required a specialist. And the only other recommendations they had were all sorts of homeopathic treatment. I was stumped, a feeling foreign to me. I can almost always figure things out. If I can't, I read about it. The books and pediatricians' advice were failing us. I tried herbs and supplements that were impossible for a picky toddler to ingest. I was ever hopeful after each successful episode of strain pooping after Elise acknowledged not to hold it in the future because it would hurt her. She nodded her head, cast her eyes downward in shame, and promised she'd try harder to be a good pooper. I went from suggesting she not hold it to scolding her when I'd see her do so. I felt bad that she felt badly about this bodily function. I couldn't get a pattern controlled for her to stay comfortable, and the guilt and pity surrounding this problem created an air of sadness in our home. So shortly after this that we moved on to the first specialist. She's seen several. So this is just a part of when on that first office visit. I described her shaking, straining, turning red, episodes to alternately hold poop and go poop. She nodded and reiterated the behavior back to me. The doctor got it. She immediately was familiar with this type of behavior and assured me that she often saw that it was common with potty training. Likely, Elise was hesitant and fearful. She expanded on what I already recognized. We were in agreement about this behavior, and I was grateful to have a diagnosis other than simple constipation that most children experience at one point or another, but successfully overcame. According to the diagnosis, this was a self-inflicted condition, a behavioral problem. So that was the beginning of how I was instructed to approach my daughter. I mean, I remember even kind of pleading with the doctor, like, well, how would you suggest I approach my daughter? How would you talk a two-year-old out of this? And then it became, well, how would you talk a three- and a four-year-old out of this? How would you talk a seven-year-old out of this? So, you know, as she got a little older, those visits, I started sitting back and letting the doctor talk directly to my child. I was so desperate. You know, you want to talk her out of this? Go ahead. See what you can do, because I don't seem to be getting through. I don't seem to be successful at this. So to take an already naturally guilt-inflicting position as motherhood and then top onto it some health problems that I supposedly was to get in charge of, you know, behavior-wise, was just impossible. They were asking too much. I couldn't do it. It was too much to ask of her. It was too much to ask of me. I couldn't do it. And lo and behold, the reason we couldn't do it is because there was more going on. So to think that all along this was something I could, you know, shame her out of or scold her out of or, you know, the other direction, encourage her, plead with her, beg her. I did it all. The full range of it went from pity to anger, all the way. So the guilt involved in just day-to-day interaction with my daughter was always there. It was always present in our relationship, in our day-to-day life.
So explain a little bit more about the regimen that we ended up having to do with years of the Miralax.
Yes, so we started off with Miralax. Everything that we would try or introduce would work wonderfully, and we thought we'd found a cure. So when they gave us Miralax back then, it was a prescription, so we gave her Miralax, and it worked for a short period of time, maybe a month or so, and it was just, I felt really great that we'd fixed this problem, that we'd seen a specialist, and I just thought, you know, because my husband sort of thought I was exaggerating by even enlisting the help of a gastro specialist with a two-year-old. And, you know, when the Miralax started working, it was great. I told her pediatrician about it right away. I automatically involved the pediatrician just because she didn't know what to do, so I would go back to her and say, okay, here's what we're doing, just so you know, for patients that you have like Elise, which she had none, supposedly, so, or none that persisted this long. So the daily regimen of the Miralax soon didn't work, and then mag citrate, enemas, suppositories, stool softeners, X-lax, and then anything I could get my hands on homeopathic, I would weave into and out of her treatment. I did not have a child that threw up. She wasn't a throwing up type kid, but I would shove so much down this kid that she would throw up. Mineral oil, all kinds of old-fashioned remedies even, castor oil, all of it. So on a daily basis, Miralax was always the go-to, but it very, in just a few months, I knew it was not going to be the cure. So our regimen varied over the years, but it eventually, before her surgery, she had two surgeries last year, she was on a once-a-week regimen of Miralax that required us staying home because she would do 12 to 15 doses of that and not eat. And so that would be sort of comparable to what someone would get while admitted into a hospital setting, where you would get the go lightly, the NG tube or drinking it. So that was sort of kept her out of the hospital with having to get clean outs with these mega doses of Miralax, which eventually also stopped working completely. I can't imagine ingesting that much stuff and it not and nothing moving. So in addition to not feeling well because she hadn't pooped in 2 weeks or 9 days or whatever day we were on, all these medicines, one alone can make you feel horrible. So it would a lot of times induce the cramping and the nausea and all those things that make you feel crummy, in addition to how she felt before she took anything. So, I mean, she would just roll around the floor sometimes, and I would just be sitting here looking at her, waiting, knowing that if she would just poop, then we could move on with life. And that's how we lived since she was 2 years old. That's what my life looked like. So on top of that, trying to get her to go to school, I worked, you know, 2 or 3 days a week. And it just, to try to explain this to people, you know, that you could be this sick over poop, to try to explain that to moms when I would cancel play dates, or even other family members that I felt knew us well, or friends, it was just, nobody was ever really mean. I just constantly felt like I was caring for a child that nobody understood, even myself. So caring for her was just nowhere in the realm of normal as far as relating to others. There's just nobody got it. Nobody got it.
How old was your child at that time?
So that regimen, the daily regimen of many, many things went on from age 2. And then by the time she was 10, we started a gluten-free diet, or maybe she was maybe almost 11, 10. She was 10. And that helped. Within a week, I had a child that pooped every single day on a gluten-free diet. So there again, she still eats gluten-free to this day, by the way. So we were just felt like we, again, found the cure. So celiac had been suspected for her. And so eating gluten-free became the new norm, and it was just a godsend. We felt like this was it. And I preached about it to anybody I knew that asked questions about how it could help, and told how wonderful it was for my daughter. And then eventually that didn't work either. And so that's when we moved on to a neuromuscular pediatric gastro specialist, where she stayed on the gluten-free diet, but she started pursuing the motility type of issues that I had never heard of. And so even on the first visit, she started talking about surgery, and I was just absolutely horrified, you know, that, you know, something more could be wrong that would even require surgery. And so I was just completely offended by the whole idea. And so they eventually did test her. They did a colonic manometry and tested her large intestinal tract. They put a sensor in it, and you watch a machine very similar to when you watch someone have a baby and they're having contractions. It's just like that. And we just watched a screen of flat lines all day long. So there finally was in front of me the answer to why my feelings of, you know, caring for this child and mothering this child and helping her with this illness had failed. All those years, a decade of failure was on a screen in front of me in one day, where it just was, she had no function. She had no ability. She had no muscle activity at all. So and then they introduced the bisacodyl via the catheter, and then stuff took off. So with help, she does have the ability. So that's why she had the surgery. So Now I'm in damage control mode, redeeming myself with my child somewhat, and that's just me. Nobody makes me feel guilty. My child does not make me feel guilty, and my husband doesn't make me feel guilty, and nobody in my life makes me feel guilty about the scrambling that I did for so long in caring for her, in trying to help her. But nonetheless, it's there because I just felt like I didn't do it well for so long and didn't do it right. But I have to balance that with being grateful, as I initially said, and then have to balance that with the excuse of, doctors didn't even know what to do with her, and so how could I know what to do with her? So the feeling stumped, feeling sad, feeling frustrated, feeling stress was just what we were used to, being completely overwhelmed. So if you mix all those things up, in your approach or my approach to mothering, it makes for a very complicated relationship. And for anybody that's got daughters, it's a tough gig anyway. So I just feel like I had an intense child, and caring for her, I got it, I understood her. But then once the health issues dominated our whole life, I just always felt like I didn't know what I was doing in caring for my own child. And that was just a very sad thing to feel like you have, it, for any health or emotional issue even, to feel like you don't know what you're doing at the most important job God's given you is unbelievably horrible. So that's why the talking with Mary Angela and others, and then writing, even if nothing ever happened to the book, has been really therapeutic to have a method of putting thoughts and feelings in order. And because I think you have so much clarity in looking backwards, at least I have. And if someone on this call or someone out there, could benefit from my own scrambling and have an easier path, either with finding doctors or dealing with your child or all of the above, then that would, be rewarding. And even more so, if someday my daughter wants to throw any of this in my face, she can just read the book and know that I had a hard time. So a lot of this is just, it's for her, because someday she'll have more clarity and have more questions about what she went through. And I think now she's just kind of skipping along and picked up with life because she feels well, which is exactly what I need her to do. But someday she'll reflect backwards and go, gosh, that was huge. I went through a lot as a kid. So my story is not necessarily, I started off writing a book thinking I'm writing about my child. And as I started very early on, I realized I'm writing about myself. She can write her own book. But I'm writing about mothering a child that goes through this and the helpless feeling that you feel, that I felt in going through it is. So writing about it and talking about it finally after so many years of really not being able to connect with anybody, even a doctor, even connecting with a doctor wasn't there. I would leave doctor's appointments and go, the doctor doesn't get it. She doesn't get it. I remember leaving her pediatrician's office one time thinking, I am going to get my kid diagnosed one day, and I'm going to have a name, and I'm going to have a medical report, or I'm going to have a result for her, and I'm going to come back, and I'm going to smear it in her face, because she doesn't get it. She's not listening to me, and she's not, she doesn't believe me. She doesn't, and not to be smug, but I just felt like when you're sitting in front of a doctor who doesn't understand or doesn't listen, and then you have to write them a check, it would almost send me through the roof. So I would leave lots of doctor's appointments, most doctor's appointments for a decade I left, shaking my head like I had wasted my time. and, you know, tossed my kid in the car and went home and thought, you know, I can't figure it out and they can't figure it out. So, you know, I, you know, would just go about my business. But it was just very, very frustrating. So that's what dominated my caregiving and raising a child. So I'm not done yet. She's 14, so I have a little bit of time left to do it good, hopefully.
And we were talking, Julie, you had mentioned, and you touched on that today, about caretaking of the caretaker. Can you talk
yes.
a little bit about that?
So, not that I feel sorry for myself, but looking back, I probably should have felt sorrier for myself and taken more time, which is probably a common complaint among caretaker, anyone that's maybe caring for aging parents or caring for a spouse or caring for an ill child is counseled to take care of yourself. And so, you know, I felt, always felt strong mentally and emotionally for the most part, but I certainly, and that was probably portrayed outwardly, but there was lots of times where I just was so scrambled in my own head about how I felt. And my husband couldn't even help because he was in the same state that I was, even though he was in charge of less things, you know, physically with her. 90% of it fell on me just because I'm mom and home with her. But there was just no real break. I mean, if she wasn't feeling good, I didn't leave her or go and do anything for myself, of course, because she wasn't feeling good. And then when she was feeling good, I was making sure I was with her all the time to do something that in that window of time when she felt well. So there was very little, you know, it isn't that I had didn't have outside interests or outside friends, but I just for a long, long time felt like I just couldn't keep up with anything else in life other than just mothering. And so taking any time to do anything I wanted to do, it was just not ever on my agenda. And so I don't really feel like I had much of a break. And it probably wasn't, you know, it's not like my husband didn't give it to me or he didn't offer. It was never even discussed as an option because I never expressed the need much for it, although I had it. So that, again, would be something that, you know, if I met a friend for dinner alone without a child, met up with a girlfriend or whatever, it would make me feel bad. And so what was to be fun or pleasant night out, I couldn't wait to get back home again. It was, I think I even wrote something about that. You want me to read something about that?
Yes, please.
So I may have kept up with life during the day, but unfortunately I grew accustomed to no longer sleeping. I'd wake up often sitting up, feeling like I'd been running. I had bad dreams about losing Elise, not her dying, but just being unable to find her. If I woke up, I never laid in bed awake, waiting for sleep to resume. If I woke up, I got up, always. I'd wander into the living room to read. Sometimes I resorted to sitting in the dark, trying to settle my distressed mind. My thoughts inevitably ricocheted between the same four topics: how Elise was doing, what day of poop were we on, what I needed to do the next day, how was Guy doing, Guy's my husband, how was Guy doing, keeping up with a stressful job, was I paying enough attention to him? I had to minimize stress at home, bills, what bills were due, what I needed to pay, what I needed to delay. I felt sorry for myself. I was down and negative. I'd love to do something for myself, but I couldn't even remember what I like to do or the last time I'd done it was, other than maybe read a book I'd chosen, a shopping day, a lunch alone with a friend, pedicure, all rare treats I indulged in only a handful of times per year. It wasn't anyone's fault but my own. I should have planned those things as I felt I needed or wanted them, spared the time. The problem was I rarely even thought of luxury, never ventured to take the time to. It didn't even come up into my mind to accept or dismiss. The times I did do things for myself, I felt guilt, like I was doing something I shouldn't be getting away with, and the joy was diminished. So sitting alone in the dark seemed like the only time I wasn't asked to do something for someone or didn't feel compelled to tend to a duty or respond to a complaint. Oh, I sound super selfish, but so now I'm just running the streets. I have a healthy kid and I'm just rearing to go. But for a long, long time, you know, I just didn't feel entitled or deserving of really being able to get out and really keep anything as a person, as an adult woman that I would have found enjoyable. You know, you throw yourself into motherhood already as it is, and that sort of dominates things that you do socially as well. But to have a sick child on top of it, there was just no time for anything else. Really, I didn't feel like, you know, I could or should take care of myself to any degree on a regular basis. So that
Julie,
was that.
When you have a patient or a family member that's ill, let alone when you have a child ill, the dynamic within the family changes.
Yes.
It either strengthens relationships or it crumbles them. They're so stressed that you're so busy caring for your child that you have to let go of other things. Can you talk a little bit about that dynamic and relationship within your family?
Of what part?
For example, your husband?
Yeah.
Talk a little bit more about that.
Well, for one thing, my husband's approach to parenting and my own, although we weren't, it wasn't something we necessarily, was a large fight. It was definitely, we were definitely not always on the same page with our approach. And so where I was more of a, as things got more intense with her, I was more of a bulldog as far as pounding the pavement and wanting answers. And he was almost more resolved as she was because he felt sorry for her. And so, you know, I was sort of on the other end of the spectrum with, you know, everyone has to stop feeling sorry for themselves because we have a job to do. We have a lot ahead of us. We have to, you know, buck up here and pull together because we have work to do. And so, you know, that caused some discord in my marriage, and we didn't always agree with treatment and getting other consultations and moving forward in directions that ultimately did help Elise. But the tension that caused, and I don't have excerpts here about it, but, you know, there would be times where I would want to be tougher on her and my husband would try to pull me back. And then there would be other times when I would, you know, for instance, she would miss school and be feeling horrible, and he would be calling me from work early in the morning when he was already at work, and he would be telling me how I had to get her up and get her ready for school, and I couldn't do it because I couldn't get her to stop crying, or I couldn't get her to sit up to eat, or I couldn't get her to, you know, cooperate to put clothes on. She felt horrible and or was depressed. And so, you know, I would tell him, I'm watching movies today. That's what we're doing. On a Tuesday, we're staying home, she's missing school, and I called in sick to work, that's what we're doing today. And he wouldn't agree, or he would, you know, want to be tougher on me, and so then he and I would go back and forth. And so, again, these were not things that, you know, tore us apart necessarily, but they were, you know, it's just another source of tension that I think other marriages and families don't have the dynamic of because of having a healthy child. You don't have those discussions. You don't have those disagreements. And we had them, you know, sometimes on a real extended term. So balancing my approach and my daughter's perspective and my husband's point of view, we were not always, you know, on the same page with things. And then feeling always like I had to do more for her and neglect him, or, you know, was he okay? You know, that's, I can't even imagine having other children. That would have even been more stressful. A lot of people have multiple kids, and they've got some with health issues with each child, or one, two that are normal or whatever, and that they want to do normal kid stuff. So just always feeling like I was spread thin, too thin, you know, was another thing that would I feel guilty about in caring for everybody in the family, my daughter and my husband.
What about living life now? You're always waiting for that to stop because your daughter is stabilized now. But
yes.
I'm sure, you know, with all of that going to happen again, what if it happened again? All of these questions, that's really a challenge because so many patients who have this or digestive motility disorders, as well as parents who have children, living with the unknown.
Yeah, so there is a large piece of unknown with my daughter. She's had an appendectomy, a cecostomy procedure twice. It tore once. So our biggest question is how long will this procedure work for her? Because she uses a cecostomy or appendectomy is where they create an open line or a stoma into the intestines directly. So she catheterizes every night and forces a flush. So it's kind of like an opposite end enema. So she catheterizes, hangs a bag, attaches it to the catheter, and flushes through bisacodyl, which is a stimulant, Miralax, and warm water. And it's about an hour-long process for her to complete at home to get her bowels to move. So she doesn't have a colostomy bag. She has this other process that she does that helps her in a somewhat normal way empty her bowels. And then she doesn't have the impaction problems that she did her whole life. So, you know, we're grateful to where she's at health-wise and that she can gain weight and grow and feel good. But whether this will be exactly what helps her for the rest of her life, we don't know. The bisacodyl could stop working. The site itself, the stoma, could constrict. And they may have to redo that. They've already done that once, done it twice. So, and the doctors that we're dealing with are very skilled and very knowledgeable, but they're young, very young. The surgeon's probably my age, and then her motility doctor is probably 5 to 8 years younger than me. So they don't have a large, long-term point of reference, you know, with other patients to compare her to. To say, okay, this process should last you X amount of years, or this procedure should buy you, you know, indefinite success. They can't say that and can't offer us that. So I don't necessarily, I'm not stressed out about it on a daily basis, but I do feel like she probably has more ahead of her on into adulthood. So it may always be something that has to be managed and fine-tuned. So at least I know that what we're doing now is working.
Julie, we're running a little bit short on time, so can you
sure.
read on page 108 to give a little bit more?
Yes. So this is when she had some other conditions. She had arthritis, and we were getting conflicting diagnoses. One of them was a staggering diagnosis of some immune suppressant therapy treatment for a year that was we did not end up doing, but it was what was suggested for her, and my husband wanted to do it, and I didn't. So they disagreed with her the type of arthritis that she had. So this is when we left the doctor's appointment. So she's about 10 years old here. We drove home in silence, too, my mind raced. I rested my head back on the headrest and said a sincere prayer and fought overwhelm and sadness. I missed feeling like I knew what I was doing with my own child. I lacked clarity and confidence. I felt like when I had a newborn and searched for the handbook of instructions that should have come attached to her. I realized I'd felt this way for some time. I'd probably only had that confident, I know what I'm doing feeling consistently with her for such a short time, only maybe between 7 months old through 2 years old when the bowel impaction took our lives over 50% of the time. Now a potentially crippling disease, incurable but maybe controllable, how was all of this spinning in the wrong direction when our child's arthritis symptoms had gradually improved? Was it any wonder I'd flipped so much at the task of having to switch Elisa's care from facility number one? Now, here we were at odds as her mom and dad disagreeing with a correct diagnosis. We had to be on the same page on this. One yes and one no equaled no decision made. We'd do nothing. That I knew. We'd do nothing until I knew more. I repeated that in my head and reminded myself no decision had to be made on that very day at that moment. One day at a time, one issue at a time. Do not argue with Guy. Do not push. Do not push. get more information, get more data, get more to establish clarity, get more, do more, learn more. I was too angry to cry. I was finally mad.
Beautiful. Beautifully said. I'm just going to tap upon two things here. And one is, I know there are so many things that you could tell other parents with children. But the first thing is, can you think of one in particular that you would be able to share and recommend to other parents? That's number one. And number two, can you talk about that, conclude with talking about that hopeful, positive view that you live by, and what you are doing in your life?
So number one, on the caregiving, I would just say that, you know, as frustrating as it can be, that there's just the anger never got me anywhere. I never really made any headway with it other than it being sort of a release for me. So avoiding anger, because it just takes a toll on yourself and on the child or who it's directed at. And I didn't flip out and beat my kid or anything like that. She was never necessarily in trouble, but she was the target of a lot of frustration. And so if I could undo that, I wish, you know, I could have controlled that at some points better. Lots of times I did control it and I kept myself in check, but there was just lots of times where I was just, you know, you have to go to school. I have to go to work today. I have to go to work today. I'm booked solid with appointments. Elise, you have to go to school today. You have a test. And so how frustrated or how angry I was usually was dependent upon what else we had that we were trying to manage in our own lives. And so if I could have handled things with less stress and just more of a calm approach all the time, I wish that was more in my nature, to just stay calm all the time. So I don't know, maybe doing more meditating or something, whatever you can do to make yourself calm in approaching, so that that is not what dominates your approach in the caretaking mode. And then number two thing, what was it? What am I doing in my life now?
Well, what is helpful to you and that you would even recommend to other people, like that hopeful, positive?
Oh, well, not, you know, it sounds like such a cliche, don't give up, you know, pound the, if I had to tell anybody anything about their own health or caring for their child, is just, you have to become your own advocate. You have to become your own advocate. So I became very, very pushy and very, always polite, but very, very pushy and very assertive at appointments. I would do research before and have questions lined up and be very organized instead of sitting in a chair and taking on that recipient role where I was just going to receive and receive and receive what they were going to give at the appointment. I had an agenda when I went to doctor's appointments. I eventually got that way. It wasn't always that way. And so that is a necessary thing. Even if you don't get all your answers managed at one time, if you at least feel like you are a participant, then you feel better about your role. And so taking charge as much a degree as you can, I think it helps you to feel empowered and confident in your approach and in the task you have, because feeling like you don't know what you're doing often is immobilizing. And so taking charge a bit and becoming an advocate and getting yourself armed with information, or at least somewhat taking charge of appointments and things as much as you can, I think is absolutely, you can't underestimate that point, that aspect of taking care of someone or taking care of yourself, is being your own advocate, because nobody cares about your health or your child more than you. So to think that you're going to go to the doctor's appointment and get some kind of, you know, confirmation or affirmation or kudos for being a great mom or being a great caretaker or really handling a lot, it doesn't happen for the most part. A doctor's role is not to make you feel good. and neither is it to read your mind. A lot of them, they don't know what more to ask other than what they come into the room thinking, and they've just left a room with somebody with a different problem. So, you know, having some control on those appointments, at least guiding them in the way that you want them to go, not necessarily just what the doctor has to say, but how, so that all your concerns are addressed, is absolutely vital.
Excellent. On that note, of time, we'd like to open it up as comments or questions. Anyone like to jump in?
I'm Mary Andrew. This is Anand, and I want to comment to Elise. I understood a little of what you had to go through because at 2 years old, I had a very bad bowel program. Things would take several days for me to go to the bathroom, and we didn't know why. It wasn't until 2004 that we found out I had bowel dysmotility and no control, because I have cerebral palsy as well as blindness. And I have another question for Elise. Now, is she able to handle that on her own, or do you have to, like, my mom has to get me enemas every night, or do you, can she do that on her own, or do you have to catheterize her?
So Elise is my daughter, and yeah. She is 14. So when she trained, we met with an ostomy nurse who only handled cases like hers. And so she was a mobile nurse that went around within the hospital, and her approach was kids 5 and up do their own. So I was a little horrified when she first got this, thinking I would have to do it, or that, I mean, I was expecting to have to do it. And she said, do you want to do it? And I said, no, I really don't. And she says, then don't ever do it once. So she was real, a real no-nonsense nurse, and she trained hands-on for my daughter to do this herself. So I've never once catheterized her or done anything with the bag process, because it's something she has to feel herself that she's got it in right, and I can't do it for her. So it would be similar to trying to clean someone's ear. You know, you don't know if it's in too far or what they're feeling. That's kind of how her catheter works. She has to do it herself to know she's doing it right.
Is it a two-handed process?
Comments?
Yeah.
Anyone?
Lisa?
Go ahead.
This is Laura. I was just curious. Didn't say, is she a pseudo obstruction or colon and mitra?
Pseudo obstruction? Chronic intestinal pseudo obstruction. So
okay.
They kind of think it may have been secondary to celiac, but she doesn't have any other neuromuscular disease or conditions that I guess are sometimes very common with the conditions she's got. So, you know, very long story short, that they think that, you know, that contributed to how it was missed for so long. You know, she's otherwise healthy child. And so...
Thank God for that.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
So she's on a correct?
She's on a gluten-free diet for some time. She was dairy-free and gluten-free because she had so many ulcers, just almost too many ulcers to even count in her tummy, and they thought that was probably due to dairy intolerance. But once you omit dairy and go gluten-free, if you have a true intolerance or allergy to gluten, you will stop producing lactase, which she had none of. So then you'll start to produce that again. So we reintroduced dairy after she'd been dairy-free for some time. Gluten-free and dairy-free is really tough. So now she's just gluten-free, and so that's a, you know, pretty restrictive diet, but we've now been doing it for about 4 years. So we're all used to it. You know, I don't have any non-gluten-free stuff in my house usually. So she needs that.
With restaurants now, their menus in line with that, so it comes at a better time if you had to have it at all.
Yes. I think even a decade ago, or even 5 years ago, we've seen a lot of progress just in the years that we've been doing it. And we have just a handful of restaurants that will rotate between. You just sort of get used to it. So that was one of the easier things that we did, even though it's a huge step to go gluten-free, because you have to be completely strict with it. You can't deviate and think you're going to cheat a little bit. You cannot cheat at all. At least my daughter can't.
So. On that note, we have the program, but I just want to thank you personally, as well as the organization, Julie, for sharing a piece of your life and Lisa's life with us, and excerpts from your book, and I'm sure you all will be hearing more about that, and once it is published, you will be getting the announcement. But Julie exemplifies someone who has been through a difficult journey, has taken those difficulties and everything that she has learned as a result of it, and then not only shares it with her book, which the purpose is multifold, but also by her experience, the way she is wired, her ability to reach out and help other people, help them understand advocating, providing a listening ear or shoulder to cry on, whatever it may be, that really speaks volumes about Julie. And we are so greatly privileged to have her as a volunteer, and so privileged that she was willing to share the story. And you will be hearing more about Julie, as she is going to be very involved in the parental group that we are having, as well as writing articles and doing other audio internet programs with us. On that note, thank you so much for joining us at this wonderful program, and clearly you got some terrific benefit in it. And also realizing that you are not alone in your journey, that certainly there are other parents who are going through this, and I'm sure some of the patients or other caregivers take away with them a lot of shared experiences and education. So thank you again.
Thank you, Mary Angela. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll talk soon, Mary Angela. All right. Bye-bye.